landfall in Florida like it was expected to. Though, of course, unfortunately, it did cause a lot of damage in Haiti. The death toll was unfortunately in the 800s, last I checked. So it's really a devastating situation there. And, of course, if you can, you donate via the Red Cross. And then it kept trekking northwestward from there and then turned west towards Florida. And there was a large West Atlantic ridge that kept it on its westward track towards Florida, and a lot of the model guidance allowed Matthew to go all the way into Florida. So, and still some hurricane force gusts along the coast, but a lot of Florida avoided the worst case scenario, but there's still plenty of storm surge and plenty of flooding along northeastern Florida, Jacksonville, with plenty of rainfall as well. If you were south of Melbourne, you didn't really get that badly, but it was really from Melbourne and north where there was very, very high mass storm surge. And then as the storm hit into Georgia, and that's where it actually eventually made landfall, the Georgia, South Carolina area, and produced a lot of rainfall there. The rain was actually further enhanced inland in those areas because there was a trough coming into the reach to the continental U.S. and the Central Plains, which allowed a little bit more of moisture expanse, the expansive nature to moisture, and allowed some more interaction with dynamics aloft, which created a lot more mechanisms for rain than just pure tropical moisture. So there are some really unique convergence boundaries along the South Carolina coast that allowed plenty of rain to fall in those areas. And I think we're joined by John now. John, can you hear me?
Yes, we are. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Great. Good to have
you
on.
Perfect.
I was just rambling about Hurricane Matthew.
Got to work out. Where'd you get to on that?
Well, I just got to, went into the terrible details of Haiti, but then I mentioned how it was originally going to hit Florida and cause a catastrophic situation. Then, the last minute north and east trend kind of spared a decent chunk of the state.
It's interesting because it seems like a lot of forecast models at the last moment decided that the storm system was going to have a real westward movement to it, generally in the vicinity of the Bahamas. And the overall idea had plenty of support synoptically when you look at the mid-level ridge that was present across the southwestern Atlantic. So
yeah,
there really weren't much other steering currents for the storm system itself. So within the strengthening phase that it was in, and then you look at the mid-level ridge as it was forecast, it kind of made plenty of sense. And the analogs for the storm system, everything pretty much lined up that the storm was going to take more of a westward heading than northwest.
Right.
As it turned out, it ended up actually encountering some land friction interference, and that helped.
Oh, that's
it
a good
really,
point. Yeah, I forgot to mention that.
It didn't. Yeah, it wasn't a coincidence that the storm straddled the coastline. You know, it wasn't just like the steering current was perfectly aligned that the storm was going to, track right along the coast of Florida, parallel to the coast. There wasn't enough push for it to be pushed inland, so instead it kind of rode in the warmer waters off the coast.
Right.
That was really interesting to see that play out.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, this is purely anecdotal, but I feel like a lot of times hurricanes almost have like a mind of their own. Like, they tend to avoid landfall in the micro scale.
Yep. And it's interesting because I haven't really seen all that much research done on that particular thing. I might be way off base on that, and it hasn't crossed my path yet. I haven't seen the research on that particular thing, but like you said, you bring up a good point. I've noticed the same thing recently to a pretty, remarkable degree. It seems like every time it gets down to right near landfall time, maybe the storm having a mind of its own isn't the right way to put it, but there seems to be some interference between the land and the storm, which I'm sure there is some kind of science behind that, but it seems more so lately than in the past, the storms will avoid landfall as much as possible.
Right. I also feel like part of why it avoided land was the interaction with the trough that came into the central U.S. and eastern U.S. And, of course,
right.
The trough was one reason why rainfall was greatly enhanced once we got inland, well, not really inland per se, but through Georgia, like why Georgia and the Carolinas got more rain than Florida did. I feel like there was trough interaction, but that trough interaction, I think, also helped there be a little bit more of a northward component than the model showed, especially considering for like the past several days prior to landfall, the models were, I think, kind of like overcompensating with weakening the trough. And they overcompensated so much that the storm missed the trough entirely and it was going to do a loop. But once it, once the models kind of recorrected by having a real trough as a feature, that allowed the storm to turn a little bit further north and actually kind of get partially phased into the trough. And that made a big difference as far as the northward expansion of rainfall through the Carolinas, into the Mid-Atlantic, and into the Northeast as well.
Yeah, so a couple things I wanted to touch on here. So let's start with the first thing. How humbling was this storm for forecasters?
I mean, God.
You know, you look at it and, you know, all the talk the last year or two has been about, you know, how we have a better handle on things now than ever. And, you know, models are performing better than ever. And that's for the most part, very true. But when you look at a storm like this one, you realize how the intricacies of forecast models and the intricacies of these storms and interacting with all these little disturbances around the tropical system can really affect what exactly happens. It was really humbling to see how 3, 4, even 5 times within the track of Matthew, the forecast models really struggled with it. And not even that, the synoptic meteorology ended up being wrong a lot of times, you know? So it was a really humbling forecast several times throughout the process. And, you know, we ended up tracking the storm for, in excess of 10 days. So I think that, you know, it felt like a lifetime, but it really was a humbling process, and there are a lot of lessons that can be learned from tracking it. The second thing I wanted to touch on, and you kind of got to it, we talked about the Georgia-South Carolina thing. That was one of the most prolific convergence zone rainfall events that I've ever seen.
I talked about that a little bit, but the convergence zone, I didn't really get into detail about it.
That is just – to see all of those ingredients come together and watch it play out is – both amazing and terrifying, because you're watching it on radar imagery and you know what's going on there. And to see all the ingredients line up, and to be fair, there were some hints prior to the event that this was going to occur. You know, there were some hints that there was a coastal front in that location and you were going to get the tropical moisture along the coastal front. But to see it actually play out and watch it unfold in real time and watch the radar imagery and then see the effects was just incredible. And, you know, and we can go back to that if you want to. But the other thing is, the quick story that I'm going to tell is I spent this weekend on Nantucket. And, you know, we had planned to go to Nantucket and run the half marathon in Nantucket. And I ended up not running. That's a whole other story. But, you know, the plan was to go to Nantucket. And initially, this is kind of just to put a bow on the whole thing and the forecast model process. Initially, it looked like Matthew was going to track up towards that area. So, you know, there was a lot of hesitancy in terms of, are we going to go there? You know, should we just cancel the whole thing? And, you know, whatever the case might be. Then it looked like Matthew's going to take this loop down to the south. And, you know, that makes sense synoptically. So we go ahead and get there. And there we are on Nantucket. And you realize that this appendage from the storm is going to make it up the coast. And it ended up being this situation where it was a tropical torrential downpour with 40, 50 mile an hour winds on Nantucket. And, you know, there was, I didn't look at the actual totals, but somewhere between 2 and 4 inches of rain and just, you know, ridiculous winds from essentially last night into today. And all the boats on and off the island were completely stopped. So as it turns out, Matthew significantly affected a lot of the East Coast all the way up to Nantucket, through pretty much the middle of this afternoon. So that's it was pretty impressive to see that just an appendage of a tropical system could get up here and cause those types of problems without the actual center of the storm being up here at all.
Right. It was really a very quick, rapid turnaround towards the model solutions that affected us with the rain. As recently as like Thursday night and even Friday morning, where most of the models were still well to the south and doing the loop. So there's really such a tight, fine line between between Matthew doing the loop and leaving a stry and actually phasing with the trough and soaking us this weekend. So that was and the rapid turnaround with, you know, the European going from a big loop back into meandering near Nicole, Hurricane Nicole, and then, like, literally the next run, trekking east-northeast up the coast and bringing an inch of rain for a lot of the region. Like, it was very quick. It wasn't like it was gradual. It was just all of a sudden, wait a minute, all the miles are giving us rain. Saturday night, Sunday morning is going to be a washout. Like, and when, like, 12 hours prior, it looked mostly sunny, and thus the impetus for you to make your trip. So that was really quite drastic. So, and
it was. And
like, the storm ended up actually phasing with the trough, you know, which was really, I mean, I can see why it happened, but considering how rapidly the models trended towards de-amplifying the trough, it ended up being kind of surprising that it ended up actually phasing with the trough and going northeast into the Canadian Maritimes. It wasn't like a piece of it. The storm actually phased, none of it looped. And I just found it very fascinating that we have that quick of a model turn in that short of a lead time. And, we ended up getting much needed rainfall out of it. I mean, I'm in Nassau County, Long Island. We had like about an inch and a third of rain. But then there was a sharp cutoff. New Jersey didn't get as much. There was still some high pressure and subsidence in the Northeast that allowed for a sharp cutoff. But I think, JFK had an inch and a third of rain. Like, I think, like, Monmouth County, New Jersey had almost 2 inches. And then, like, Southern New Jersey had upwards of 3 inches. And then, I think, as you said, Nantucket got, like, 2 to 4 inches of rain. So certainly a very interesting storm on a lot of levels. And then...
Yeah, I think Southern New England really needed the rain. They're the ones that need it more than anyone.
Right. But, so we kind of... The effect was twofold as far as Matthew turning northward and phasing with the trough, because one, it gave us rain, and two, because it phased into the trough and went into Canadian Maritimes, it enhanced the northwesterly and northerly flow behind it, which allowed this cold shot to be a little stronger than what was originally progged as well. So Matthew trending northward brought in more cold autumn air, and we're feeling it today.
Doug, that was an excellent segue. That was as good
Thank
as
you.
They get.
I try.
Becoming a pro right in front of our eyes. So I agree. And I think I was just, my segue was going to be with the subsidence, but yours totally beat mine. But speaking of subsidence, we have this high pressure overhead, and it's a very impressive one. If you haven't noticed it, you know, it's getting very cool tonight, and we have, I wouldn't necessarily say ideal radiating conditions, but we have very supportive conditions for radiational cooling tonight. There is some moisture left around that maybe it's not necessarily as dry as you would want it to be, but it's clear skies, calm winds, and a cool air mass overhead. So the usual locations are likely to get down to, cold temperatures. And the National Weather Service has obviously posted all the frost and freeze headlines that you would normally see, and I figured this was a good time because I feel like this maybe isn't necessarily discussed that much, and I'll let you lead off and then I'll follow up with some thoughts on this. But people listening and kind of that aren't familiar with radiational cooling, we obviously in a very basic sense it's the heat escaping, but let's talk a little bit about why some areas radiate better than others. You know, like why does parts of Central Long Island get down into the 20s when it's, 48, 50 in New York City? And that might be an extreme example, but something similar to that. You know, let's touch on that, and you can kind of, lead off on this and kind of discuss what are the differences there between the Pine Barrens and New York, and what that causes the Pine Barrens to get so cold on nights like tonight.
Well, it's one of these magical words that we heard a lot in college, albedo. Albedo is pretty much the number that indicates how much, radiation a surface can absorb, for lack of better words.
Right.
And the albedo is much different in sandy, grassy, woody surfaces as opposed to urban concrete. Because a lot of, you know, with radiation or cooling, you have, it's heat that's at the ground and it has to be willing and freely able to escape. And in the urban area, concrete jungles and all these buildings around, heat is going to tend to stay trapped at the surface. The albedo indicates that the heat will be very easily absorbed and not free to leave. But in sandy surfaces or the wooden surfaces with no buildings, no interference like that, the heat can easily just escape from the ground and into space. Another interesting thing about radiation cooling is that it's also dependent on the type of cloud cover you have, because it's a different wavelength of heat that comes in to the Earth than leaves it. So sunshine and heat filter in through high clouds. The high clouds often don't really stop much much solar insulation from getting into the surface. But then high clouds at night will block the long wave radiation that tries to escape. So if you can clear, if you have high pressure aloft, and you can clear out all the high clouds, then the long wave radiation can escape from the ground into space. But if you have a lot of high clouds lingering, then the high clouds, which while it didn't prevent the heat from getting in, it would prevent the heat from escaping. So you often look at high clouds, and sometimes just a couple of little strips of high clouds that move in can mean like a 5-degree difference as far as radiation cooling is concerned. This is a sharp, fine line, which makes it tough to forecast, but you can see a several-degree difference in a very short, you know, in a very short distance because of things like this.
Yeah, and I think that's such a great point. In order, you know, there's a fine boundary or a fine line between ideal radiational cooling conditions and subpar radiational cooling conditions, and you see it very often. You know, even if you get a slight wind shift in some areas, the temperature will be totally different. If the dew point rises a little bit because some onshore flow begins or some marine air gets in, it's a totally different ballgame.
Right. Because you need, you need constant dry air for radiation cooling to occur as well. Because when your dew points are, well, as with radiation cooling, there's lift of air parcels because the heat is escaping into space. But when you're getting lift, at some point you're going to have to condense. But if your dew point, and when you start condensing, the cooling actually slows down. So if you have a very low dew point, that means you're going to start condensing at a much lower temperature. And if you're condensing at a much lower temperature, that means there's more room to cool off quickly. If your dew points are very close to your temperature, any radiation cooling will immediately start condensing and the cooling process slows down. So that's why the low dew points are very important for the process as well. And then with the wind, with radiation cooling, you know, you actually get a surface inversion where you have very cool temperatures at the ground because the heat's escaping, but then warm temperatures just above because the heat's going into those areas. So if you have a temperature inversion at the surface that's helping you cool, that needs to be maintained as much as possible. But if any sort of wind will kill off that inversion and allow the temperatures at the surface, which have been cooled, to mix with the temperatures aloft, which have been warmed. So that's why you need the wind to stay calm as well. So any little, like temporary, like 5 mph wind gust can dramatically halt your radiation of cooling. But if you stay calm for several hours, then the temperature can just feel free to plummet. So a lot of intricacies in radiation of cooling.
Yeah. How many times have we seen the forecast low temperature completely bust on the warm side just because the winds stay a little too high?
It has been
the bane of my existence many times with the low temperature forecast. And it's funny though, because this discussion actually, we can go a little off track here. When you were looking at the low, you know, near record lows in New York, with the city, it's kind of a whole different ballgame. because in order to get really low temperatures in New York City, you almost need some of the opposite as compared to the really calm conditions. It's almost the exact opposite.
Right. It's weird to forecast with like pretty much opposite methods for the city's lows as opposed to the coast lows. But well, not the coast, but the interior and Pine Barrens lows. But this example is very true when this past February, when New York City finally got below zero, there was very strong cold air advection. But with cold air advection, you're really dramatically cooling off your air mass, which obviously will inherently cool the surface. But with cold air advection, in order for it to be very efficient, we need strong winds to advect that air to begin with. But strong winds inhibit radiational cooling. So you're looking for conditions that inhibit radiational cooling to support the stronger cold air advection to get the city to be cold. But then there's also the exact wind direction, because if the winds are northwest, then you're downsloping off the Appalachians. And if you're downsloping, it's hard to continue cooling down. But if the winds turn more due northerly, then you're not downsloping off the Appalachians. You're just sending cold air directly from Canada. And as that night went on, the winds, not only at the surface, but aloft too, shifted from northwest to north. So once I saw that in the soundings, that the winds would actually shift to the north, that's when I became optimistic that New York City would get below zero, and they did. So, pretty cool that night.
That was cool. It's funny because I guess it was the year before, right, when we were talking about trying to get below zero, and the first bad sign was we were looking at the forecast models, and you could actually see the area to the southeast of the Great Lakes was warmer because the northwest winds were coming over the lakes and causing warmer air to come into the northeast. And that's another thing you have to deal with, because that warmer air can seep all the way down towards the coast if the northwest flow is strong enough. And that, you know, that's another problem that kind of comes along when you're dealing with that. So anyway, we got a little off topic, but we're getting towards winter anyway, so it's kind of time to discuss this stuff. So what else do we have on the agenda? I'm sorry. For any of you listening, I am on the road with headphones on. I'm not talking and driving. But what else do we have? What else do we want to cover here? I think we have, what, a couple minutes left? 5 minutes?
Yeah, about 5 minutes left. Yeah, we can quickly go over a couple of things.
Sure.
I mean, I was looking at a couple of things regarding the winter because, you know, the time of year when it's cold, when it's getting cold, you get into that mood where you think about winter, you start thinking about snow. You know, like long-range forecasting isn't really my favorite thing in the world. It's pretty tough. But I did see that.
That's my department.
Yeah, it is your department. It's your thing. two things I noticed. One, the La Nina doesn't appear dead. I mean, it's not going to be like a moderate or strong event, but I think NOAA went a little bit overboard and canceled the La Nina watch because I do see some La Nina conditions. And with also the PDO dropping. So if this La Nina picks up, that could have some implications on the winter. Though it's still be pretty weak, so it's still tough to say exactly. And then on the snowier side of news, apparently the European seasonal model shows a very cold and potentially snowy pattern for like December and January, which of course gets a lot of people excited. So that's all I got on that. But what do you think?
Without giving too much away of our winter forecast, you know, the current state of things is kind of in limbo in terms of, you know, what we're looking at. All the data is one of the tougher winter forecasts I can remember in quite some time. You know, there's no real pattern driver. There's not many stout signals pointing in either direction. The one thing that I definitely lean towards putting into the forecast is an active storm track for the Ohio Valley. I think particularly that the Mississippi and Ohio Valleys will have a very active year. And,
I agree.
You know, what happens to the east of there is kind of going to be dependent on, you know, what it usually is dependent on. What is our blocking situation? You know, what is the state of the Pacific jet? And, you know, obviously in turn with blocking, you start talking about the state of the AO and the NAO. And a lot of that is never usually, not well, never, but a lot of that is not typically figured out until the end of October as you get towards November. And to be quite honest, you know, a little, just open this wide open and talk, you know, make, put it out there. Our winter forecast that we put out last year, which ended up being extremely successful, the ideas that we had in terms of blocking, you know, we didn't formulate those until the end of October. We didn't get those finalized until the end of October. You know, those were last minute additions. This year, more than any year in the past, you know, there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions, and obviously the La Nina, it will have a large impact. But contrary to last year, my thought process with this year does not center around the state of the tropical Pacific. It centers a lot more around what's going on right off the West Coast in the Gulf of Alaska, and what's going on over the Atlantic and Greenland. And obviously the La Nina has some impact on that, but I don't think it's like similar to last year where we're looking at the tropical Pacific to kind of guide the forecast.
Yeah, it's definitely tougher to forecast the winter when there's no strong ENSO signal, because then you're leaving it up to things which are harder to predict and have more variability. Because and when you have more variability, it you know, it makes it tough to really hone in on constants and themes to winters. And when, even if you get the deep, like some of the intricate details wrong, if you have the themes correct, that usually leads you in the right direction. But it's hard to even get that far with, you know, with the conditions being the way they are, especially considering how tough it really is to actually predict blocking and in the North Atlantic region. Because if you look at the sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic, they don't look good for a negative NAO. But there are some stats that I've seen with correlating an extreme negative October Arctic oscillation to an extreme negative winter Arctic oscillation, or at least some extreme in those winters. So we actually do currently have a pretty strong negative AO pattern, which in October can often portend some cold and snowy periods. And of course, it's hard to say for sure how much of an impact that really has, but I do think there is something to a blocky pattern setting up and then recurring during the winter. So I think, you know,
me too.
For snow lovers, that is some good news, but otherwise it still is pretty tough to say anything definitive. But anyway, unfortunately, we are running out of time for tonight. We really appreciate you guys listening. And our next episode will be next Monday night, and it will be every Monday night throughout the fall and the winter. So we look forward to having you guys on and listening throughout the fall and the winter. And I'd like to thank John for joining me tonight on short notice. And
you got it.
We'll talk to you guys soon. Take care.